The forms of things bear their own particular message. Here on Kaldor 5, there is an unsettling irrationality about many artifacts. That mountain in the distance, Angdor, I think they call it. Why should it look like a pyramid, point down? Or take this forest. Some of the trees are 10 feet in diameter. Why should they all lie flat upon the ground? Or those birds, the magpie, who build their nests upon the air and who work in relays to support its weight? Why do clouds regularly form themselves into arches? These are only the more evident mysteries, and each mystery has a mystery hidden within it. I suppose they are all rationally explicable, even predictable, but not by me. What worries me most just at the moment is this. Why do mirrors on Kaldor 5 never reflect back what looks into them? In some ways, my position is ridiculous. Thanks to mechanico-hypnosis, I can speak 3 of the major languages on Kaldor, but my sense of nuance is completely off. I have the same trouble in speaking Spanish. We Terrans tend to believe that language is always intentional, that sentences are equations denoting operations, orders, sensations, that words mean what they say. But this is untrue, even on Earth, and especially here on Kaldor. Words are intentional here also, but they tend to be used for other purposes. Words are used with extreme indirection. To them, I suppose, it's all very logical and inevitable. It is not impossible to extract the meaning from most exchanges. What is tedious is the work involved. Because this great effort must be made with everything, nothing comes easy, nothing can be taken for granted. This must explain the high rate of emotional malfunction amongst interactors. The problems of extraterrestrial exploration are always the same. First problem, how to stay alive. Second, close on its heels, how to stay sane. The uncertainty tends to be maximized. The biggest danger on an alien planet might well be anxiety. Culture shock is the problem. An overload of novelty is insupportable. One tends to blank out, to stop registering, or to do so in a hasty, inattentive manner. Decision-making is also affected disastrously. There are too many imponderables to be weighed, too many courses of action to be chosen among, and always on the basis of insufficient information. A paralysis of the will sets in. One reaches a point where you can't decide whether to make fried eggs or boiled eggs. Everything must stop while this decision is being made. And when it has been made, one is too exhausted to eat. I used to think that exploring an alien planet would be like seeing a very strange movie. I was prepared for that. But I had not counted on the fact that I would be a participant, not a spectator. Lanea came by today to see how I was getting on. Or at least I presume that is why she came. I find her presence both disturbing and comforting. I have grown accustomed to her anatomical differences. Her extreme physical flexibility, a trait she shares with most other Kaldorians, is still a wonder to me. The appearance is one of bonelessness, especially in arms, legs, neck. She can turn her head a full 180 degrees and look directly behind her. I have asked her not to do this in my presence. I have every reason to believe, though I have not yet verified it, that her sexual structures, concealed under her clothing, are similar to those of a Terran woman. Will I ever find this out by actual experience? I should not be thinking such thoughts. Her face is a long oval, delicately proportioned, beautiful by Earth standards. She has a faint Eurasian look, but ironically enough, she would not be considered exotic on Earth. She could pass unnoticed in a crowd on Earth, except for her walk, of course, which is sinuous, flowing, faintly repelling, faintly exciting. Her appearance doesn't bother me, quite the contrary, but her mind. One cannot expect to understand any woman, I suppose, but what is one to do about an alien woman? Nothing, of course. Anyhow, what would Lanea want with me? In her eyes, I must be a freak, both in appearance and mentality. Dernish is in his 50s, apparently, a lean, spare man of great dignity, a holder of a seat on the council. He came here today and tried to warn me about something. I do not know what it is. Despite my best efforts and his, I could not make it out. He seems to have no specific danger in mind, yet I cannot believe that a man of Dernish's intelligence would waste his time and effort on a general statement about the danger of the world. So I may have missed a subtlety in Dernish's speech. God knows what else I've missed, and what wrong assumptions I am operating on here. Still, I wish I knew whether or not there is a specific danger to me. I was a volunteer in the first extraterrestrial exploration corps. We were all very young and idealistic. I could conceive of nothing more noble and important than the task of exploring the planets, establishing contact with other intelligences, working toward a great harmony and cooperation. Now I can take that sort of thing or leave it. But then I was a zealot. I passed all of the tests, and I was among the first 1,000 to go ET. Our ships were small. They were not places in which to live. They were cocoons in which to hibernate. We were scattered into space like seeds cast to the winds. Well, we weren't exactly scattered. We were aimed, more or less. The ships were constructed to home on various selected planet-bearing stars, to examine those planets for various criteria, to awaken the explorer if the planet proved viable, and then to land. Or to leave him in hibernation and travel on to an alternate target if the planet were unsuitable. Optimists thought that half of us might live to see an alien world if we were extremely lucky. Their predictions didn't matter to us. We considered this work a crusade. 20 ships were keyed to Kaldor 5. Mine seems to be the only one that made it. Dernish came again today with 3 other members of the council. They harangued me for about 3 hours. They were all dressed in their ceremonial robes, I suppose to underline the seriousness of the occasion. It was hard to take them seriously. The 3 who accompanied Dernish might have been selected to exemplify the basic somatotypes. Grandinglang was a roly-poly endomorph, nearly bald, choleric, incoherent in his exasperation. Pan Wulfing was the mesomorph, a powerful man of medium height, blunt-featured, self-possessed, courteous, with an athlete's unconscious grace even in his smallest gestures. And Eliaming was the ectomorph, skinny and intellectual, brilliant and erratic, ancient and boyish at the same time. The 4 of them had come, I believe, to make me understand the danger I was in, something about night winds, and to make that danger more evident to me despite language difficulties. They supplemented each other's explanations, interrupted each other to clarify various points, introduced a historical background, argued about the import of various recent events concerning me. The result was chaotic, disturbing to all of us, uninformative, and not at all helpful. Dernish asked me to attend an important ceremony or holiday in the city in 3 days. It seems to be more than a casual invitation, so I shall attend. It begins at dawn tomorrow. There was a stiff breeze last night, the first I can remember in some weeks. Might not that be the night wind they have been referring to? I ate lunch, and Lanea still had not come. I lay down on the sofa and fell asleep. I had the following dream. I was walking down a twisty cobblestone street in an ancient village. 2 people came from the left and approached me. I started to ask them a question. They seemed afraid of me. They turned and ran. I ran after them, wishing to reassure them of my good intentions. but they would not listen to me. They ran faster, outdistancing me. Then I reached the center of the village, and there was a great bonfire in the plaza, and it rose higher, higher than the church, but I felt no heat. Then I woke up, shaking, frightened, cold with sweat. Lanea came just a moment after that. Lanea is very beautiful and loving. That is some compensation for the steady attrition of my humanity. We play a pretty domestic scene, Lanea and I. She brings me breakfast, walking briskly into the bedroom in her swirling morning coat. I drink a warm, mild stimulant, about the equivalent of coffee. I am the only person on Kaldor who does this. Little habits like that help me to remember who I am. Then I work on my notes, slides, tapes. After lunch, I go for a walk. Usually, I turn away from the city into stubbled fields and second-growth forest. I take along a flute that Wolfing made for me. Its tones are not quite true, but I don't mind. My own tones are not quite true either. There is a hill several miles from here called Namasi. I usually climb it and sit on its pointed top all alone, playing my flute and resting my eyes on distant scenery. I play When You're a Long Way From Home and Amapola and Flying Down to Rio and other songs that are all but forgotten even on Earth. The songs sound strange in this place. The notes are a miniature invasion, bravely piped, soon lost in the immensities of Kaldor. While playing, I am a Terran, but at night in Lanea's arms, I do not know what I am. Not a Kaldorian by any means. Not quite human either. A changeling, perhaps. Lanea knows with her own wisdom who and what I am. Sometimes she holds me very tight, as if I might fly off into the vacuum of space. Sometimes she holds my face in her two hands, looks into my eyes, and makes a strange sound deep in her throat. Sometimes she squeezes my hand, tight, tight. I do not think I will ever be rescued. I will live out my time here, and if there is a heaven or hell, it will be a Kaldorian one to which I will be consigned. Or perhaps there is a special limbo for those who have severed their roots, who are no longer of one stock, not yet of another. In the meantime, I have no real complaints.